Question number 11766, to T.H. Harville, Reel 1.
Mr. Harville, Reel 1. Can you tell me how and when you came to be in the RAF, please?
I was doing war work. I had taken a course in Southampton as an aircraft detail fitter, and I did war work in a factory fabricating Spitfire parts. So on the strength of that, they just recently created for the four engine bombers the position of flight engineer, who more or less looked after the technical side of the aircraft and flying and acted as co-pilot. So volunteer flight engineer. And
but what made you want to change from the one to the other?
Well, I'd had always had a fascination for aeroplanes, and used to read all about them. And when I was a lad on Camford Heath at Poole, I saw three of the pre-war biplanes dropping bags of flour on territorial soldiers, and it sort of captured my imagination, you know. And I think that was the germ of it. Another thing was probably motivated a little bit by revenge, because I took this course, aircraft fitters course in Southampton, at the height of the Blitz, and having bombs raining down, being in digs near the centre of the town. I remember telling the landlady that I'd have my revenge and fly up the under den Linton in Berlin and drop a few there, you know. I never did get to Berlin, but
so did you go right through the Southampton Blitz? Were you in Southampton
worst
the whole?
In the, of course, it was stretched over a fairly long period, but the main Blitz was over a period of 2 or 3 weeks, and there was real devastation, especially the lower part of the town.
Where were you living?
I was living above the central station, just above there. And that actually was hit by a landmine. I never used to go into the shelter. I used to get it on the lawn. I don't know why, but it was a silly thing to do, I suppose, because of the shrapnel coming down from the guns, you know, firing. There were actually a mobile anti-aircraft gun was positioned outside of the where I was in digs, you know.
What was your objection to going in the shelter?
I don't know. I felt the chances were better out in the open, you know. It's probably not a really clever decision to make, but I felt better that way, you know, being out in the open.
What were the shelters like? Were they squalid?
No, there was one. It was just the ordinary Anderson shelter, you know, in the back garden of the digs. And of course, the landlady and her family went down there.
Can you remember any other particular bombs that dropped in the Southampton Blitz and on any particular buildings or streets?
Well, Northam, the night the landmine dropped on the central station, Northam, which was the lower part of the town near the docks, was really devastated. I suppose the fire started down there, and high explosives were aimed at the fires, and therefore that part was really badly damaged.
Was that the worst night you can remember, or were there others just as bad?
Yeah, that was the worst night, because the bombs you know, although a lot dropped in northern, some came up, landed in the centre of the town, as I say, and they were creeping up towards where I was living, but fortunately none landed there.
Did you get the impression that the Germans were going for military or industrial targets or going for civilians?
No, I think they were going for the docks. It was quite easy for a bomber pilot to target the docks because you have the two rivers conversion and the whole shape of the... if they've studied a map beforehand, the water would show up. And I think they aimed at the docks, but, fires were created further in from the docks. And I say there was quite a lot of damage, civilian-wise.
Were the docks hit much?
Well, they were more hit and earlier on, before I got there, because there was a bad raid when the cold storage plant was hit. And that was the biggest damage ever in the docks. And that burned for days and days, you know. It was all the butter and the meat, all the fat in there, you know. Had to drag it. That was considered the worst damage that occurred in the docks.
Did you see any planes shot down?
No. I don't think they had much... The bomber pilots had much worry, really. It's the guns, they weren't concentrated, mostly on the light side, you know. And I think they were dead unlucky if they got hit, you know.
What was public morale like?
Oh, it was pretty good. I used to wander down and go and have a drink, you know, and although I was underage then, I was only 16, but I used to go in it was marvellous, really. Mind you, a lot of people had left the town, you know, there'd been an exodus to other country parts, you know, and each night, you know, the sirens, if they thought there was a raid coming or it seemed likely, or especially when the sirens went, then people used to flock out the town, you know.
But did you meet anybody for whom the bombing got them down?
Not really, no. I can't remember that happened at all. I was meeting the other trainees at the training centre, and they talked of it as a great experience, you know. It was strange, really.
As though it was exciting.
Yeah, in lots of cases, yeah.
What did they think to the German flyers who were doing it?
Well, you can. I think it's probably assessed when the Battle of Britain pilot Nicholson was shot down in VC. He was shot down over Southampton Millbrook in daylight in the Battle of Britain. And when he was coming down, he'd rammed him. Although he's on fire, you know, he'd continued and shot down an ME-110. So the German pilot, or one of the German crew, got out, and Nicholson himself came down by parachute, and they were both shot at by the Home Guard, you know, and Nicholson was wounded, and so it was a German airman.
Shot at as they were coming down in parachutes.
It was the old LDV, not the Home Guard then, of course, and so that was the attitude, I think, of the local people towards it. Although he's an RAF chap, they assume everyone that's coming down was Germans, you know.
So was there real hatred of the German Air Force?
I think so, yes. It's, Jerry this, Jerry that. I never heard of any airmen being lynched in that may have come down in this locality, but that was a case in point, the shooting of the of Nicholson.
Do you remember which months you were in Southampton? Can you name the months?
Not really. I think I know it was winter time. You know, dark evenings was the rage used to start quite early in the evening.
Were you here in Southampton at Christmas time?
No. I think it must have been January, February, something. Yeah.
41.
Yeah. It's odd, really, because I was only reading the local paper had a write-up anniversary, of the Blitz, 1940 and 1919, the 50th anniversary. And when I was reading it, I could have, noted the dates then, I think. I should have done, really, because for my own interest.
When you got the job in the factory making Spitfire parts, was that in Southampton?
No, that was in Poole. It was a subcontract firm.
What was the name of that firm?
The Wallace Tin Stamping Company. Previously, they'd made bottle tops and things like that, and then they converted over to war work.
Was it a big factory?
Oh, it was quite a busy one. It was geared, for high production of bottle tops and that, and previously. So they had a lot of workers there. Very crowded,
Was it hundreds of people working there, or what?
Well, there was, in the aircraft section, I'd say about 120, 130, something like that.
What kind of Spitfire parts were they making?
It was ribs and airlines. They're complete, and they were also making parts for naval aircraft, but only small parts.
What was your job in the factory?
Well, I was making prefabricating. The machine. The girls would stamp out the pieces, the ribs and whatnot, with rings, a wing say, and it had to be annealed, softened, so it could be bent to strengthen it, and flanges put in to strengthen it, and that's what I was engaging. And of course, it was a strict you had inspectors of the Ministry of Aircraft Production would test and examine everything that was made, so if anything was sloppily made, it would come straight back to you, with a sort of ticking off, and of course reminding you that RAF airmen's lives were dependent on the quality of the work.
Did you take that seriously?
Yes, I did. Particularly on the run up to when I was going in the Air Force myself.
How long were you working in that factory?
I was there. I was about 16 and a half, I suppose, when I returned from the course. It was a 3 month course up at the training center. And I was there right up until 43, August, the beginning of August, when I joined the Air Force.
Was there much sense of urgency in the factory amongst the workforce to support the war effort?
Well, a lot of them were thinking more of the money they were making, because it was good money. And it was a bit remote from the war down there. All right, one or two bombs had dropped on Poole. I actually saw a Junkers 88 drop its bombs on the town, but one afternoon. But very little had been seen of the war there. So there was not the same sort of attitude there as there was in Southampton.
Was it people there? Was it mostly women in the factory?
Well, in the stamping out stage, were women, young girls, and a few older women. But regards to the actual aircraft work, it was mainly men. And some were quite skilled men, you know, they had a lifetime of that sort of work, engineer work, you know.
Were there trade unions in the factory?
Well, there were, but they didn't seem to have much to do with the running of the place, you know. It's, the shop steward, people run the shop steward if they had a real complaint, but I don't think it really affected the factory very much.
Were there any strikes or industrial action?
I can never remember. There certainly wasn't when I was there in that 18 months.
How did the women fit into the factory? Were there any problems having women in the factory?
No, because most of them were segregated in another part of the factory. Because the machinery that stamped out the parts and that was heavy machinery that had been put there for making bottle tops. And the workshops with the aircraft, where the pieces were actually fabricated into parts for the Spitfire, you didn't need heavy machinery. Most of it was hand machinery, if any, you know. And it was mostly files and filing and put something in a vise and knock it over with a mallet, you know, to shape it.
You said
there was nothing. The girls wouldn't be skillful enough in any case to have done that work.
Why would they not have been skillful enough?
Well, not without the training. You see, I came to Southampton and I had the training. And that's the only reason I was doing it, working with skilled engineers, you know, who'd probably have been older men, you know, that have been working in that line for years. So these girls, you know, although they could operate these heavy machines, they couldn't have worked to the quality, the tolerance that you had to satisfy the aircraft inspectors.
You said that the wages were good. Can you give some idea of what kind of money could be earned?
Well, I can't remember now, but I do know that in the average wage that was then, you know, for an adult, they were taking on 2-3 times as much of what they would have normally earned. And there was one chap there, he even employed young boys, you know, to do work for him, unskilled work, that is, down in the factory. He'd send them down to have something done, you know, down into the heavy machinery was. And that man, he was really making a bomb, you know.
Was that done with the approval of those in charge of the factory?
Yes, he was a sort of godfather, you know. Strange, but there it is.
Now, coming back to the RAF, you said that you went in to be a flight engineer. Can you tell me what work that involved?
Well, the flight engineer, I would say you didn't sort of do repairs on engines or things like that. That was the ground crew would do that, the fitters and the mechanics. But a flight engineer, he's required to know the aircraft from nose to tail. Hydraulics, electrics, instruments, and he's got to know a little bit about each person's job, how to work the gun turrets. Not to navigate, obviously, but use the radio. Oxygen supplies, that was important, you know. I found that when an emergency one day. So all in all, it was sort of a jack-of-all-trades, and you could even drop the bombs if it needs be. You know, you could sort of. Of course, this the training consisted of 1 week of each, you know, subject throughout the course. You do a week hydraulics, a week electrics, a week's gunnery, and so on and so on. And you also had to, you did link trainer experience and dual control in the conversion unit, so that you could take over from the pilot to fly at least straight and level if you weren't required to land the plane. if needs be, you get the plane back and bail the crew out, bail out yourself after turning the aircraft out to sea. That was all I was required to do.
What was the first operational squadron you went to?
No, it was just the only one, 514, at Weir Water Beach. It's three group.
Can you tell me about the squadron, about its composition, the type of people who were in it?
Yes, the 514 squadron was one of the last squadrons when I joined it to have Lancaster 2s, and they were fitted with radio engines. And while I was on the squadron, they converted to 1s and 3s with the Merlins. So it was a different operating business altogether, you know. And different engines required different operating regulations and requirements. So I had quite a... When I was on the squadron, I switched from one to the other, you know. So it meant... remembering, you know, exactly what engine you had there and the different operating requirements. But the squadron was previously a Stirling squadron, and I'm very glad that they converted the Lancasters before. I take off my hat to anybody that flew Stirlings, slow lumbering things, you know, and flying below the level of the Lancasters. Getting all the flak. Like your early Halifax, they were in the same position. Anyhow,
was the air crew in the squadron mostly British people?
Yes, they were. Well, when I joined, you see, the crew is trained on Wellingtons, but being a twin engine, they got no flight engineer. So you meet your crew on the squadron for the first time. The crew was already formed previously, and they worked together, and they flew together. But anyhow, there was two crews. There was a conversion flight on the squadron, which I did for 3 weeks for air training, you know, with another flight engineer. He was an ex-regular airman and fitter who had converted to... as a flight engineer. There was two crews turned up, my crew that I eventually went with, and another crew that consisted of Canadians. And I wasn't keen, you know, getting to know the Canadians. I wasn't keen to go with them. And
why not?
Well, nothing against the prowess of Canadian airmen or anything like that, but you know, they have a certain you know, they knew it all, sort of thing, you know. And it made me a bit wary of them, you know.
You thought it would be more dangerous with them.
So the other engineer went with them, I crewed up with them, and I crewed up with the crew that I remained with throughout the time I was on the squadron. Anyhow, as it turned out, they never came back from the third operation, so the Canadian crew. So. Probably sixth sense, I don't know. But,
who was in your crew then?
Well, the skipper, he was first class. He was Well, he's flying officer, and I crewed up with him, but he got promoted to flight lieutenant around the time we were together. And he's been training aircrew in America. That's why his expertise as a pilot was first class, you know. And there was Robbie. He was the navigator. He'd done a tour in Wellington's in North Africa, so he was the only one of us that had experienced flying under fire, you know. There was the bomb aimer. He was a flying officer, but he'd done no previous operational flying. And the two gunners were straight from the gunnery school, you know, well, via the Wellington training unit. And there was the rear gunner, he was 18, and the mid-upper gunner was the oldest, he was about 28, 29, 30, and the wireless operator just a little bit older than me.
How many operations did you do before you were brought down?
Well, 11, and we started off, the first one was the marshalling yards at Valenciennes on the Belgian-French frontier, you know. And that was to prevent easy access through to the coast with panzers and whatnot by train. Anyway, I think we clobbered the railway, not too much damage to the civilian population. We got attacked on the way back. Come over northern France there, and fortunately we ran into a bank of cloud and lost the fighter. But we saw a silhouette of a burning bomber on the ground, so we'd already had one kill. So it wasn't a very good start. And taught me one thing, it was to take the benzodrine tablets that they used to dish, the medical officer used to show.
What was the object of them?
Well, they would keep you awake, you know. It's so easy to drowse off in an aircraft cabin with a drone in the engine and the darkness and that. And after we, on the way back, you know, I was just in a dozy state when we got attacked, you know. Of course, they give you a bit of a lift too, but unfortunately, I lost for about 4 hours. And about 4 to 6 hours, but when they wear off, just the opposite happens. You know, you feel really depressed. You know. What they do is speed up the heart.
Do you remember anything about the other operations that you did before you were brought down?
Yes, there was a number of them. Most of them were on the Paddy Cully, on the Doodlebug sites. They started sending over the doodlebugs, and it was a top priority, you know, to knock them out if we could, but it was pretty hopeless. They were deep underground, concrete emplacements. Anyhow, we did our best, and we did about half a dozen of those, and then we did a most memorial one was at Vidderch Bocage one afternoon, beautiful afternoon, and there's 250 of us, Halifax and Lanx. The 6th and 8th Panzer Divisions were in woods there in Vidderch Bocage, and they were poised to attack for a night attack, which would have split the